So just to give you a sort of where we are going to go before the end of the semester, today we'll be starting state-based planning, basically reasoning with change and planning. And probably I will continue planning next class too, so it's in fact probably one class down. And then we will do, essentially, we'll start talking about how to do reasoning with change when you have stochastic transition. Today we'll be talking about reasoning with change when there are deterministic transitions. When we talk about stochastic transitions, we'll look at a very interesting idea called Markov decision processes, which essentially are at the same level as state-based search, except how do you do state-based search if you have probabilities, if you have stochastic transition. So one of the interesting things is that we started, if you are considering the topics, and suppose this is atomic representations and relational representations, first order representations, okay? And then you are considering the various topics chronologically as the semester went on. First, we started basically talking about atomic representation search, okay? And to some extent, by the time we went to CSP, it's relational representation because the state now has structure, okay, in CSP. Okay? So you went to CSP, and then you went to first order logic. So of course, when we're talking about FOPC, we'll get to first order logic. What we kind of do is, so this is time axis right now. I mean, you could do the same kind of a thing. For example, that's the knowledge representation angle, and you can write this for, as the time went on, did we look at deterministic versus stochastic? Right now, up until now, we basically are in deterministic, right? So we went search, we CSP, then FOPC, and then today we sort of go to relational representations again in planning. Because I'll actually start by saying you can do basically planning as theorem proving in first order logic. And then we'll talk about some tricky issues, and then we will say, we'll just do it at the relational level. Okay. But then you can say that this relational level planning could also have been done in the atomic level. Okay. But I guess if you can, the interesting idea would be to do anything at the most expressive level that you know how to do. Okay? You can normally always do things in the atomic level. You understand search in the atomic level already. And then you understood how to do it, at least for a special class of search, how to do it at a relational level. Okay? And you'll again understand a special class of search how to do for planning, which is again actually search. Okay? And then we'll come down and then we'll say, well, we want to do stochastic transitions. But then we never actually explained how to do search when you have stochastic transitions. There was no clean model for searching with stochastic transitions. Okay? And so we need something at the atomic level first so that we can again go up. Okay? So because of the topic, when we come to the stochastic transitions, MDPs are at the atomic level again. You could do MDPs at the relational level. So any idea you understand at the atomic level, you try to do it at the relational level, and you try to do it at the first order level. That's the best, that's the way progress happens. But you first have to understand it at least at the atomic level. Otherwise, you have no clue. Okay? So we'll do MDPs at the atomic level, and then we'll do what else? The adversarial search, which is basically game playing, sequential game playing, such as chess playing. You will again understand it first at the atomic level. Okay? So that's how it goes. In fact, I should have actually written some more in between these. So there was search, there was CSP. Then there was propositional logic. Then there was probabilistic prop logic. and they were all at the relational level. Bayesian networks, they're all at the relational level. And then we went to first order logic, okay? And then we came down to planning. Today we'll be doing planning, but mostly at the relational level, okay? We'll start here, but then we will, you know, for reasons that you'll understand, we'll do mostly at the relational level. And then we will actually, when we go to stochastic models, I'll explain first of all how to do it at the atomic level. Okay. Again, one of the things that you want to keep in mind, this is a big picture, and one of the things you want to keep in mind is anything we are currently doing at one level, eventual goal is to be able to do it at the higher level. Okay. If I'm not teaching you, it's either because we don't quite understand how to do it at the higher level, or because it's meant for graduate level courses. Okay, so for example, for propositional, for probabilistic logic, I didn't tell you how to do it at the first order level. Okay, and that's partly because there is some work there, but I think it's out of the scope of an undergraduate level course. Okay, and similarly, there is some work on MDPs at the relational level. There is also some work at MDP on the first order level. But again, it's beyond the scope right now. Okay. So I think this picture, I should actually, if somebody can draw this picture and send it, give me a copy, so that I won't forget, I'll probably put it up on the on the lecture notes. I think it's a very useful thing to understand, because we are, we're going in topics in a chronological order, but then the topics themselves move in different dimensions up and down. And, it's important to understand, suddenly when we go to MDPs, why are we talking about state space model? Well, because that's where first you have to understand. Once you understand it at the level, then you go higher up. Okay? And since we are running out of time, then basically that's the only part that we will do in, kind of MDPs. And then, of course, after that, we will spend, after that research, we'll spend time in learning, which mostly we will spend time in learning at the relational level and maybe atomic level, okay, but not at the first order level, okay? That's something. And then you can do the same thing for different other axes. In fact, unfortunately, the other axes are not anywhere near as interesting. So for example, if you said deterministic, stochastic, non-deterministic, then pretty much what we've done until now is at the deterministic level. Okay? And anyway, so that's basically where we are going for the rest of the semester. And then already we are kind of one class shifted, so presumably I will be doing learning starting 28 and 30 and the last class. And one other interesting point is that I would be away on 4/28, unless things change. I have to be on travel on that day. So most likely I will bug you to find a time the week before, to do an extra class that I will record. And then if those of you who can't make it, you just see the recording. But those of you who can make it, you'll see. Listen to me. Okay? So I think it would be the Friday. 4/28 is a Monday, and it will probably be the Friday before that. Okay, and that will also give you time to make up for that last class. I mean, that if you don't come on a Friday, I mean, I think I'll hold it sometime around this time, 10:30 time frame. And then I'll give you the details as to where it's going to be held. And those of you who can't make it, listen to the audio, or I'll try to record it too, in a video form if I can. And then, by 4:30 I'll be back, and then I'll just start where I left off. That's where it's going to be. Okay, question? Yes, sir.
Once per class.
Oh, no. one more homework, and the projects, I don't think there is any bigger projects, but there may be things like, if we are lucky or unlucky, depending on which side you are on, we might do something like the Bayes network kind of a project for maybe planning. So where you don't write any code, but you kind of write a domain and then play with an existing planner, if we have time. Okay. Other question. Okay. So today we are going to start talking about reasoning with time and change, and you know, a topic that's very closely connected to that is planning. In fact, in some sense, the world does change, and we are interested in figuring out what actions to do to the world such that it would go to a desired state of affairs, which is more or less what we thought all agents are interested in to begin with. Okay, so we'll start looking at that, and we have basically the first order logic. For example, we understand relational logic, we understand first order logic. We can also think of reasoning with change at the state space level. In fact, one might say that you already reasoned with time, right? Because you did the 8 puzzle. In the 8 puzzle, there were actions. There was a state, which is the puzzle state. There were actions, which will give you another puzzle state. So you already know that one understanding of reasoning with time and change in the state space level, in the atomic level, is basically state space search. Okay. To some extent, what we'll try to do is to see whether we can do it at a more expressive level, so that we can state the things that we know in a more compact form. Okay. So there are a bunch of things, you know, from the planning perspective. Even if you don't really care about just making an entire intelligent agent which has all the various, you know, capabilities such as reasoning with time, reasoning with and being able to learn, and so on. Even if you are not interested in the end goal, there are all sorts of interesting applications for the kinds of, if you are able to reason with change. Okay, and these are some of them. And I guess this one, for example, the more interesting one that I should mention is the Mars rovers. They essentially had to figure out, you know, how to get to the point that they need to get to. And one of the interesting things is, why not do teleoperation? Right? In fact, you know, if you have a robot and it needs to go somewhere, why should it have to be autonomous? You know, why not just do teleoperation, you know, remote control? And on Mars, if the robot is on the Mars, then remote control is a little too tricky, because essentially it takes how many minutes for the signals to travel? Yeah, some number of minutes at least. So it's like, you know, I mean, of course, if it's Sun, it'll be 8 minutes, and then if it's Mars, it's less than that. So 3-4 minutes, and then it just says, I'm about to fall into a ditch, what do you want me to do? And you know 8 minutes later, you tell it what to do, it's too late. Okay, so in some sense, I mean, even if you never cared about autonomy, you know, and you'd say, why can't I just control everything in my life? I mean, you're a control freak and you just want to control everything, and you feel this course is kind of a waste of time because you know how to control stuff, right? You'll still have to deal with, you know, autonomy, because I mean, you have to allow the agent to reason about its own future, because it's just too far away, you know, you cannot actually control it. Okay, but there are other things that, you know, instead of you doing it, you'll let the programs do it. Okay, so they're just names. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but what I want to go back now is to, let's see, if you want to reason about time and change, what can you do in the context of what we have learned till now? And so we actually go from sublime to ridiculous, or ridiculous to sublime, or vice versa. Having seen rovers, we now actually think of blocks world. Okay? So there are named blocks. Okay? And we'll use this as a toy example to figure out how to reason about change. Okay? So you have various named blocks, and they are on a table, okay? And you're trying to, they're in some configuration, and you want to put them in some other configuration. And there are a bunch of operations. The kinds of operations, maybe you have like a robot hand, and which can pick blocks, okay? So let's assume that you know how to pick up blocks, you know how to put down blocks, you can stack one block on top of other, you can unstack a block from on top of other. So the difference between pick up and unstack is, pick up is picking up stuff from the table. This is just blocks world. I'm explaining blocks world to you. Okay, we want to model this in a language we understand. So pick up basically picks up stuff from table, unstack picks up from another block. presumably these are different actions, because on table you can just hold it like this. If it's on another block, then if you don't hold it properly, the whole stack below will just, you know, fall down. And then similarly, put down and stack are different in the sense put down means you're putting it on the table, stack means you're putting it on top of another block. Those are the actions, let's say, that we have in this domain, okay, in this world. Okay, so the question, of course, is if I give you some configuration and you want to go into another configuration, you should be able to reason as to what actions should you do to get to that other configuration. Okay, or if I tell you, you know which configuration you are in, if I tell you a certain action has been done, you should be able to guess what the world would be like after this action. All of these we were interested in doing, right? So let's try to do it with respect to situation with respect to first order logic. Okay, now the way until now, first order logic basically was general enough, but we didn't quite argue or quite decide how to represent change in first order logic. Okay, so I suggest to you that it's not that hard, really. In fact, first order logic is general enough that you can find a subset of it, which will be, a specialized version of the first order logic, which is actually quite good in reasoning with change and time. Okay, and that's what I want to explain to you. And so in trying to explain this to you, basically I'm also making you think more about first order logic that you thought about last week already. Okay, so the idea is that a special class of first order logic called situation calculus. It's first order logic, but it has a little more commitments. Okay, remember, first order logic only has the commitment that there are objects in the world and they have relations between them. That's all it has. Okay, situation calculus says not only are there objects in the world, there are special kinds of objects in the world called situations. Okay, and the situation is just a snapshot of the world. You can think of it as a snapshot of the world. And basically what you need to do to explain what is true currently in first order logic is you can't just say the following is true, because it can become false in a different time frame. Okay, so you have to say this thing is true with respect to the now, the current now. And so the way you would do that is you will say something is true with respect to a situation. Okay, so the general idea that we are going to go with in the background is every property, things like, so for example, to describe this Lotzwohl domain, you might want to say things like on XY, right? Or you may want to say things like clear X, okay? Or you might want to say things like on table X. These are all relations, I just made them up. Okay, now the point is, if I just say on AB, in what sense am I supposed to interpret this? Is A is on B forever and ever, irrespective of what I do, or is it true only in a particular situation? And normally what you want to be able to say is, initially A is on B, and after some action, it may or may not be on B. Right? So in essence, one idea is to say that every one of these properties have a situation argument. Every one of these properties has a situation argument. And the situation is a special type of an object. It's essentially, you are saying the world now contains these objects called situations, which are the snapshot of the world. And similarly, the question, of course, is how do situations change from one situation to another situation? Okay, that's what actions do. Okay, and so we make up, situation calculus also assumes that so it has made the commitment that there are situations, special terms for situations, and there is a special term, there's a special function called result. I just make up a special function called result. And the whole point of result function is that it takes a situation and an action name and gives a new situation. And this also means that I need special terms for actions. And you notice that now I have made three kinds of extra commitments. A normal first order logic doesn't have to say that there is any kind of special terms. Now, situation calculus is a special kind of first order logic where it thinks there are situational terms, there are action terms, and then there is a special function called result which takes you from one situation to another situation when an action is applied. Okay. With this, I argue that you can actually represent, you know, what you know about a situation and what an action does to a situation. Okay. To put that in perspective, so for example, special terms called actions are things like put down A, stack B, X, etc. Okay. Where these are terms, these are not predicates. So, and then a result is a function which is basically applied to an action term and a situation term. And that essentially involves doing that action in that situation, and the result of that is a situation itself. So in fact, you assume that this itself is a new situation term. Okay? And so I get to say result of doing put down A in situation S. Okay, so in fact it's all a question of which convention you use. I mean, I have to write here, since I wrote it that way, I have to say action, situation. Okay. Part of this discussion also tells you something about how people start from the first order logic and come up with specialized subclasses of first order logic that are actually well suited for, you know, representing certain class of knowledge. Okay, just as you have a general purpose knowledge in a language called C, and then there are all sorts of specialized C dialects, which let's say somebody who is in real-time programming wants a real-time version of C, you know, which has certain built-in support for that. So similarly, think of situation calculus as a dialect of first-order logic that has built-in support for change, situations, actions, etc. Okay. So I can, and then world properties themselves can be modeled as predicates with an extra situational argument, just as on X, Y, S, clear X, S, so here clear B, S0, etc. Okay. Situational terms can be constants or can be variables, just as any other terms. Okay. So now once I have this, then all I need to tell about the domain, that the particular instance of the problem, is define the initial situation. You know, let's assume the initial situation is a constant called S0, and then make a bunch of statements about what is true in S0. I can say A is clear in S0, B is on top of C in S0. Okay? So I made statements about the S0, and then I need to make statements about what happens if an action is done in a situation. Okay? And those would be essentially statements of this form. Okay? So for example, this one is saying, for all X which are objects and S which are situations, if it is true that X is being held by the hand in situation S, if it's true that X is being held by hand in situation S, then if in the situation that results from doing put down action, in that original situation, it would be the case that X would be on table. How many of you are lost? It's just basically a way of saying that if X is being held in the current situation, then X will be on table in any situation that results from doing put down X in the original situation. That's all. So all I'm saying is now action descriptions look like first order logic statements, first order logic axioms. Right? Okay. Now, this one, by the way, this is one type of first order logic axiom where, in fact, it is combining a situation S to another situation that results by doing an action in this situation. Okay. But you can also have intra-situation axioms. In fact, first order logic is, you know, the full power of first order logic is at your fingertips now. If you make a real-time dialect for C, that might have some support for real-time stuff, but you also have entire C at your fingertips now. right? And similarly, you have the entire first order logic at your fingertips, and so you get to even say things like this. So for example, in this blocks world, right, what does clear mean? When I say a block is clear, what exactly am I saying? I'm saying there's nobody on top of this block. So clearness and onness are connected in a deep fundamental sense. If you're a blocks world mathematician, you would write a theorem on it, right? And your theorem would basically say that for all y and s, for all x such that not on x, y, s implies clear y, s. This one is saying that in any situation, in any single situation, if a certain block doesn't have anybody else on top of it, then it must be the case that that block is clear. Do you understand what I'm saying? So not only I have properties, I can actually relate the properties. And I can relate properties across situations. I have everything, it seems to me, to be able to now, you know, so I converted everything into first order logic. And I know how to do theorem proving, right? I know how to do complete theorem proving, complete and sound theorem proving for first order logic. You know, forget about complexity for a while. It's only semi-decidable. So you can, you know, write whatever you want. If you want to solve a planning problem, essentially it should be, you should be able to give a theorem to be proven by the planner. And the planner proves the theorem. Okay? And if it finds a constructive proof, if it finds a constructive proof, right, then the proof will tell you how to go from the current situation to the situation where everything that you want is true. Right? Okay. So now you should be able to understand these as well as this. This is basically action descriptions, and these are intrastate axioms. In a given situation, if certain things are true, certain other things are true. You can write all of these. Okay. Now, in situation calculus, you know, if you can write whatever you know in situation calculus, it looks like planning is nothing but theorem proving. Right? This is a good news, because we spent all this time understanding FOPC. Now you write whatever you know in first order logic, and if you have a theorem prover already ready to go, you can just do planning with respect to that. Okay? So how would you do it? Essentially, I'll take a very little example. I'll say in the initial state, S0, A is being held. That's true. And I also have an axiom about holdingness. It says if X is being held in a situation, so basically this axiom, okay? If X is being held, then after you do put down, X will be untable. And suppose my really strong planning problem right now is to make sure in the previously A is being held, right? I want to be in a situation where A is untable. That's all. It's a very small problem, no, admittedly. So I want to get to a situation where A is untable, and I can ask my theorem prover the following question. Given that this is what I know, does there exist a situation where A is untable? Does there exist a situation where A is untable? And if the theorem prover says yes, that means the plan is feasible. And in saying so, if it gave me a constructive proof, it actually told me how to get there. How many of you are still following? Okay. So basically, I'll just have this, and you know, the cute thing is now I just converted it into something that I already know. So I have a bunch of first order logic axioms. I have a goal statement. I negate the goal statement, convert these guys into clausal form, convert this into clausal form, do theorem proving. If I get an empty statement, I mean, if I get an empty class, then I would know that the theorem is provable, and then I can also find out for what S is the theorem provable, and that will tell me the plan. Right? Okay. So that's basically what happened here. So I started with this one will become not on table AF dash. Do you realize that if you negate it, then it will become for all S not on table AF. And I'm doing, you know, standardization of variables apart. So this is like a little repetition of last class. You know, if you didn't understand theorem proving last time, you were hearing it again, except in a slightly different form, for a more specialized logic. Okay. So there is not on table AS dash, and then I need to make this true, and I do have this. right? Basically, I have, when I convert this into classal form, I will essentially get not holding XF or on table X result put down XF. Right? Okay. And then I can make this and this unify. Can make those two unify by making X equal to A and S equal to S dash. And then these two get cancelled out, and I just need to prove that, and now I'll basically subgoal on not holding AS. And then I unify that with holding AS0, which is a constant, and I'm able to then say if S equal to S0, these two will cancel out and I'll get an empty class. Okay, so I have proved a theorem that there does exist a situation, where A is on table. Okay, now which is that situation? Figure out what S got, figure out what S dash got bound to. Okay, and basically S dash got bound to result of putting down X in S. Okay, so that basically tells you that start from where you are and do put down, and then you will get to the relevant situation. So when these things work right, in essence, the situation that you are looking for would be bound normally to result of doing action an in the situation that comes from result of doing action an minus 1 in doing situation result of doing an minus 2, etc. And you just do the actions in the opposite form, and that's your plan. Agreed? Okay, the whole point of this is A, that you can actually convert what you want to do in planning as just a theorem proving task, and since you spent all this time understanding how to do theorem proving, you're done. Almost. Okay, now we will start talking about, is it really done? Okay, that's the question. So basically this is arguing that in fact you can think of planning as theorem proving in first order logic. Okay, but the next couple of slides I'll try to argue that it's not as easy. In fact, there are certain issues that you have to deal with. Okay, first order logic, yes, sir.
What happens if there are multiple ways to achieve the same goal? Does the first order logic have to do this? Maybe not.
Yeah, of course it can. If there are multiple ways to achieve the same goal, then there is going to be multiple proofs, and all you need is one proof, so any one proof will be found.
For example, if you want to go to one place to another one, so they want to find the shortest path. So
no, okay. So for optimization, keep that separately for now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's just say we are trying to find the feasible plans for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and at least that's not a problem. If there are multiple ways of achieving goals, that's like essentially saying for your prologue theorem prover, by the way, which is almost there but not complete. Theorem prover for first order logic. By the way, there is an extra credit task for the prologue project where I get you to do this using your prologue theorem prover. Obviously, you can't do it all the time. If in fact the existing axioms that you have are all Hahn clause, then your prologue should be able to do it. If not, there may be a proof, but prologue theorem prover can't find it. You understand? Okay, so in your prologue case, right? If you say, is there an apartment pet? There may be multiple apartment pets. It'll show you one. You ask some more, it'll show you the next one. In fact, one of the extra credit portions, if I haven't forgotten, is how to get your prologue theorem prover to keep coming up with more and more solutions rather than just one solution. Okay, of course, the trick is after it comes with the one solution, then you again say, I failed. And then backtrack to find another solution. Okay, procedurally there is not much of a deal. Okay, so in your case, in fact, you can even get diverse multiple plans by making prologue solution, prologue find multiple solutions. To the extent the knowledge itself is in definite clauses, then prologue will find all the theorem, all the proofs. There are other tricks. In fact, a huge big thing is what's going to be discussed next. But it turns out there are also other interesting things I already gave you, that you should force your theorem prover not to find existential proofs. Okay? Imagine what would happen. Remember the bomb in the toilet problem? Somebody doesn't even remember bomb in the toilet problem. I am very surprised. But it's very important, okay? So, but the bomb in the toilet problem, there are, you know, two identical looking packages and one toilet, and all you know, and you don't know which one has the bomb, okay? And all you know is, if you put the package, you know, containing the bomb in the toilet and flush it, then the bomb is disarmed, right? Now imagine trying to do that, and that's a plan, by the way. I mean, there is a plan for getting out alive, right, in that situation. I hope you know, I mean, if you're ever stuck in toilets with bombs, right? Now the question is, if you try to do this with first order logic theorem pro, what would happen? You give all your knowledge and you ask, is there a situation where I am safe? And the most likely thing the first order logic theorem pro will say is, yes, sir. And then you say, which one? He says, in a situation where you happen to do the first branch, first package, or in the situation where you do the second package. But you say, which one? It doesn't know. It's sort of like, you know, where did I leave my keys? I mean, are my keys existing somewhere? Yes, they are. Where? You know, either at home or office, which is what I started with. Okay? So if you find an existential proof, it will come and bite you, because plans cannot be existential. Now, saying that something can be done is of little help to you. You need to be able to actually do it if you want the plan. Okay? So in that kind of a scenario, if you want to use your first order logic theorem prover to solve the problem, you have to force it to find a constructive proof. Even if it found an existential proof, it should ignore that and move on until it finds a constructive proof. And I have pointed out that sometimes things can have both constructive and existential proofs. And existential proofs are, I mean, I made a big deal that we should keep them in logic, but not when you have to work on, I mean, use that proof to actually decide what your plan is. Okay, so this is a deeper issue that, in fact, you need constructive proofs if you want to do plans based on those proofs. Okay, but there is an even bigger problem that I want to talk about, which is basically this. So, consider the same exact problem. Okay, now I just have another block B. Apart from A, I have another block B. Okay, and which is already on the table and it's clear. Okay, A is being held, B is clear. And my planning problem really is just get A is onto table, leave everything else as it is. In particular, that means leave B clear. How many of you think this is a harder problem? Most of us don't think it's any harder than the previous one. Okay, but how many of you think that the first order logic theorem prover, given the same knowledge, can solve this problem? Basically, what happens is, you know, if you can visualize the proof right now, it would be you're looking for a situation where A is still on table. I mean, you're looking for a situation where A is on table and B is still clear. But you only know that B is clear in the S0. How do you prove that B is clear in the situation where A is on table? How do you prove that B is clear in the situation where A is on table? You think, that's a no-brainer. You know, I didn't do anything to B. So you should know that. But first order logic can't assume that. Maybe you did something. If you want to say that you didn't do anything to B, you should say that explicitly. Do you understand what I'm saying? You should say it explicitly. So what you need to say basically is that, so first there are two points. Point one is this theorem will come all the way in the new problem, this theorem will come all the way and get stuck trying to get rid of B being clear in the state where A is on table. And it's unable to prove that. And the only way it can prove it is if you go and tell it that when this action is done, not only does X now is on table, you also have to say if clear, B was clear before this action, B will still be clear after this action. That's a little worrisome, because you would think normally actions should be written in terms of what they change in the world. But what you're asking is for this first order logic theorem prover to progress, you need to not only say what it changes, what an action changes, but what an action does not change. And there can be a huge number of things that an action doesn't change. If you actually, so normally, if you would like to, you know, pick the world that you get to live in. And the consideration, there are two considerations. Consideration one is, you know, here are two worlds. World one, where every action changes everything. Okay? World two, where every action changes a few things. Okay? And you're trying to pick between these two worlds. If you're interested in just survival, your basic survival, which would you pick? This one. If you're interested in making first order logic do useful stuff, you know, as per planning, which would you pick? This one. Right? Because in essence, in this case, everything changes everything anyway, and you're forced to write every this thing. Whereas here, you feel like a fool trying to say, oh, it doesn't change this, it doesn't change this, it doesn't change this. A million of these. Okay? So, there is a little insect called Spix ichneumonias. Okay? And it's a very interesting insect. It's one of, you know, insect kingdom's brightest insects. Okay, so what it does, you know, you can read this as I'm talking. What it does is the following. People have looked at this insect, and you know, when you think that humans are intelligent, you know, you have to worry whether or not other things are intelligent or not. And here is this insect. What it does is when it lays eggs, right, it puts them in a little burrow, and now these eggs will one day hatch, and then the new insects will come. And you know, have you ever seen little birds coming out of their eggs? They're like ravenously hungry, right? And they're coming out saying, oh my God, I'm hungry, give me something. And then that basically means the mother has to hang around there. And Spix, on the other hand, is a mother on the go. And she can't be hanging around, you know, waiting for the eggs to hatch, right? So Spix, what it does is it brings a little other thing, I forget which one, it brings a cricket. It catches a cricket, sort of doesn't kill it. If it kills it and puts it in, the idea is that keep the, you know, basically write a little note to the, you know, things that come out saying, you know, open the refrigerator and eat. I'm gone, right? And the point, of course, is how do you do it? You can just, you know, there is no refrigerator, so you can kill a cricket and keep it. If you kill a cricket, you know, it'll start decomposing after a while before the eggs hatch. So what this guy does is, it basically stuns the cricket. It puts enough poison in it that it's in a suspended state of limbo. Right? And then leaves the cricket in front of the eggs, and off it goes. And then the eggs, when they hatch, the new sexes come out and then basically, you know, eat from the refrigerator, so to say. Now, don't you think this is totally intelligent? I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, you would need, this sort of makes it sound as if Spix is thinking about the world at large. And, you know, it should basically, it already took 471, you know, and it knows how to do this stuff, right? Now, what's interesting is that some people who have even less work to do than Spix have actually done experiments with Spix, right? And what these scientists, jobless scientists, did was they really wanted to see, really, my God, is this that intelligent, or is it biological determinism? Is this stuff written into its genes, or is it actually thinking? Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, now, because evolution can actually write a whole bunch of things into genes, because of, you know, and it can be explained, as long as you have deep enough time, we can evolve eyes, which are very complex things, but they have evolved multiple times in the evolution, in multiple different branches. All you need is deep enough time. Okay? So the question then is Spix actually intelligent, or is it just an evolved creature which evolved to do this? How do you figure this out? So these scientists did the following thing. They would essentially, when the Spix goes, puts the cricket in the burrow. So basically the way it does it is even more interesting. It brings the cricket that has been stunned, puts it outside the burrow, goes into the burrow, looks around, comes out, looks around, takes the cricket inside. It's even more interesting. Now it's actually not only doing all this intelligent stuff, it's actually making sure that there are no bad guys hanging around before it puts the food in, because they might come and eat the cricket. Right? So now what these guys do is, when it leaves the cricket and it goes in to look into the burrow, the scientist will move the cricket a little bit, 3 millimeters to one side. Then it comes out, realizes that the thing has moved, and puts it back into the right place, goes again inside, checks to see everything is fine, comes back again, and the scientist has no work, so he moves it again 3 more millimeters, and then again puts it back, and apparently there was a person who did this for, on one occasion this procedure was repeated 40 times, always with the same result. And I'm very sure that Specs wrote a journal paper on the scientist too, saying humans are such jobless creatures, they have nothing to do. But more interestingly from you, what is it you think is happening in this? Essentially, it's doing first order logic theorem proving to some extent. It knows what actions can do, but it is not sure what actions cannot do. In a way, it thinks that, you know, the fact that this thing has moved a little bit, it might mean everything in the world has changed. So I have to reprove everything again. Okay? So the point that I'm making here is, you know, if you have to write axioms about everything that doesn't change, eventually, I mean, or if you don't write those axioms, you will start acting like Specs. Okay? So anyway, you will have to write these axioms in this particular case about every action that doesn't change, you know, for all the, you know, actions and all the fluents, I mean, all the properties that are not changed, there should be an axiom saying they don't get changed. Okay? Now, the question, of course, is how bad is this? How bad is this really? And there are two different things that are bad about this. I want you to understand that. First thing, of course, is it looks like you have to write a huge number of extra axioms. A huge number of extra axioms. Okay? For every property that doesn't change, also you have to write that. Now, that problem can be somehow reduced in its, you know, complexity by essentially writing for each fluent the only conditions under which that fluent will change. So, in particular, what this is saying is, instead of writing k times m frame axioms, an axiom which basically says, think of each situation as a frame, okay? And in some sense, if you're a cartoonist, you are writing frames, right? You're drawing frames, and then for the next frame, everything in the background almost remains the same, except Bart now has showing, you know, one finger of Bart is about to raise. And in the next one, it has risen to its full extent, and then so on. You see, that's how the frames are written. So in essence, you're asking, you know, in the frame problem, you're saying what parts of the frame change from one frame to other. And so a situation is the one which is taking you from a situational frame. An action is one which is taking you from a situational frame to another situational frame. And you need to not only say what it changes, but also essentially write down what doesn't change. Okay? And you can reduce the number of axioms essentially by just kind of compressing them. So instead of writing k times m frame axioms, you can get by with just k frame axioms, where k is the number of fluents, number of properties, and m is the number of actions. So you would just write one axiom for each property saying this property will change only under these conditions. And so you write an if and only if axiom. So this looks as if you can actually handle this. The other problem is a computational one. What happens really is now you would have an axiom basically stating that if in fact clear B was true in S0, then it will still be true after you do put down A action. Right? Now that axiom has to be used in this proof. The proof has to go one extra step deeper. Okay? That's a huge computational problem. Imagine a world where there are 10,000 properties. All you want to change is one property and leave everything else alone. Now, basically, you are saying you would prove that one property, that property that you care about has changed in one step, more or less, a few steps, and then spend something like 9,000 extra steps proving that none of the others have changed. And if you know that theorem proving is search, which you should, right? Theorem proving is search because you are trying to figure out which clauses to, you know, resolve and there are lots and lots of choices. By the way, I didn't discuss search in theorem proving when we came to first order logic, but I did discuss this for propositional logic. Remember set of support that you had to do in the first order in the midterm? All of that stuff just is relevant also for first order logic theorem proving. Okay, so theorem proving is search. And in search, if you increase the depth, the time increases exponentially. So there's a huge computational problem. Two. Okay, now how do we get out of this? One way of getting out of this essentially is to sort of go out of monotonic logic and say that every statement I made are default statements. And you can actually make one statement about put down X saying, by default, when you do this action, the only thing that changes is on table. Only thing that changes is holding becomes on table. Everything else by default remains the same. Now, you know, that's, as I mentioned earlier on in the semester, you know, non-monotonic logics are a very interesting line of research. But there's also not, I mean, A, I didn't teach you, and B, there are also computational issues as to how to do efficient theorem proving there. Okay, so one possible direction that you can do, and in fact your TA who is sitting here would actually argue for it, because I believe he is going to be, you know, coming up with an efficient approach for these kinds of problems, is to actually try and use non-monotonic logics, okay, and, you know, do reasoning with change effectively. Okay, the other is to give up on, other is basically to just say, I'll compile down this assumption into my representation that the only things that change are the ones that I said will change. So everything else by definition doesn't change. Okay, now if you do that, that's called Stripps assumption, and if you do the Stripps assumption, it turns out that you may as well be actually living in a simpler representation. Once you make that assumption, you can actually talk about the implications of such an assumption in something called a state variable model, which is closer, if I had that picture around, it would be closer to the relational model of the world than the first order model of the world. Okay? Now, what's a state variable model? A state variable model, you assume that each state is defined by the values to n different state variables. For now, we'll assume they're all Boolean state variables. Okay, and then, so a complete state is defined by truth, falsity, you know, of the complete set of variables. When did we last think about this? CSP. So it's almost up to here, it's just CSP, except I would say, in CSP, the actions are of a particularly dumb kind. You know, which is all you do is in the beginning all the variables have no values given to them, and then as you go, you know, in a systematic CSP at least, each action picks a variable, gives it a value, that's it. Here we actually look for actions which will take any completely specified world and give a new completely specified world. So which can flip some of the variables on, some of off, and leave the others alone. Okay, so that, if you do that, it turns out it is actually expressive enough, this is to talk about change in terms of state space models. Okay, so let's look at Bloch's world, the same Bloch's world that we were looking at, except now think of the world as defined by a set of state variables and their values. Okay, so essentially what you would wind up doing is, if you spend time writing a first order logic representation for the Bloch's world, you can still use all of that stuff. You know, if you had an on x, y, s, just get rid of x, s, and say on x, y is a state variable. And it can be either true or false. Okay? So state variables in this problem are like on table x, on x, y, clear x, hand empty, holding x. And in general, they are for every possible constant. You have to write on table A, on table, on BC, holding W, etc., which are all the constants. Okay, that's your initial state is defined in terms of the state variables, you know, the truth, falsity values of all the state variables. And so initial state is a complete specification of truth falsity values to the state variables. And by convention, since you are giving complete specification, by convention you can just go ahead and assume that I'll only write the ones that are true, and if I didn't list anything, that must be false. As long as I know beforehand that the state is completely determined, then all I need to do is to give what is true, and then everything else will be false. Or if you like more false, then you can try what is false and everything else will be true. The convention people normally use is, you know, they'll write the true ones and then everything else would be false. Yes?
How is this different from the
situation that it happens? Yeah, let me complete this. And in fact, you know, part of what you have to do is, let me complete this and we'll again come back to the issue of how it differs from situational logic. Okay? You should be worried about this in the back of your head as I'm going through this. Okay? I made up a huge problem that I said first order logic has, and I'm giving this supposed solution, and the question is this really a solution? And what is it giving up? What is it giving you? Okay. So goal state is a partial specification of the desired state variable value combination. Okay, so basically you are saying this state variable must be true, this must be false, I don't care about the rest. Okay, and the assumption then is to find a sequence of actions that will transform initial state to some state where the variables have the values that you want them to have. Okay? Now, what do actions do? Actions essentially doctor the state. They basically algebraically doctor the state. Okay? So an action is defined in terms of preconditions, which are what state variable must have what values before the action is taken, and post conditions, which are what state variables must have what values after the action is taken. And these are both partial specifications. They only write what actually they care about. So if this one is saying hand should be empty, X should be clear, and X is on table, as long as those are present, I can do pick up X. And it doesn't matter to me what else other blocks are doing. And then in the new state, any new state that comes out, X will now, the state of X will be holding. I mean, the state of holding X will now be true. Whether it may be true or false before, it will be true now. And similarly, on table X would be false, and hand empty would be false, and clear would be false. What about the rest of all the properties? They just are the same as before. And so you copy them over. And it's this copying over operation which saves you the 9,999 steps. Because you just copied over the state except for the things that changed. Right? Okay? So this assumption is the strict assumption that basically the definition that we have is, the semantics we have is, if an action changes a state variable, this must be explicitly mentioned in its effect. It must be explicitly mentioned in its effect. It looks like a pretty harmless assumption, but it can start getting on your nerves after a while. Okay, I mean, you do give up something when you give up expressiveness. So for example, suppose I know that this action puts, you know, A on top of B. Must I be forced to also say that B is no longer clear? I mean, everybody knows that if A is on top of B, B is no longer clear. Must I be forced to say it? Well, strict assumption says you better say it. Okay, that's basically what you lose. Okay, so in essence, you have to state everything that would be changed by the action. And if the action changes, if the world changes a little bit, you have to redo the whole thing. Okay, I mean, you have to rewrite the action. Whereas, in the case of first order logic representations, if the action changes, all you wind up needing to do is add an extra axiom. Okay, and there is an idea called elaboration tolerance, which, you know, people care about, which is how much of the knowledge that you have about your world has to be rewritten when your knowledge about the world changes a little bit. And something is elaboration tolerant if you can add the change as an extra sentence and be done with it. If not, then you have to go into people's minds and kind of change, you know, every little piece of knowledge they have such that it's rewritten again. Strips assumption essentially makes you do that. Okay? In particular, suppose I'm in this blocks world. I'm in this blocks world, right? Except my blocks are of varying sizes. Not all of them are of equal size. Some are big, some are small. Let's say, in fact, there are only two sizes. One block which has 3 square units area on top, and then some blocks which have, no, one block which has, yeah, 4 square units area on the top, and another block which has 1 square unit area. So clearly, in this world, if you put a 4 square unit block on top of another 4 square unit block, the bottom one is no longer clear. But if you just put a 1 square unit one on top of a 4 square unit one, it's still clear. It has space for 3 more guys. Nothing else in this world seems to have changed. All that you changed is how clearness comes from putting things on top. With that one change, if you are writing actions this way, you have to rewrite every one of them to make sure that they are consistent. If you are in this world, if you are in the first order logic world, then all you need to do is redefine clear axiom. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so what you lose when you go from this expressive thing to the less expressive one is you have to repeat stuff. And, you know, for those of you who are in software engineering, you know, who have written programs, know this. There is an issue of modularity. Okay? Why do we need subroutines? Why not write in line? Every time you use, like, a sorting program, why not write in line how that sorting program is? Okay? Well, the problem is if you made a mistake in the sorting program, or if you want to change the sorting a little bit, now you have to rewrite every piece of the program. Whereas if you have subroutines, then you just change that one and everybody who calls has automatically changed. So that's the difference between higher order languages and assembly language sorts of programming, right? And that's the difference between first order logic and Stips assumption. But you give it up, I give up the expressiveness for the reasons I explained to you, because with that expressiveness, we really need either default logics or we are sunk. Do you understand what I'm saying? So what we are doing is, since we have to compile the assumption that nothing changes unless I told you so, I might as well compile it. And to the extent, you know, it means I have to write, you know, C programs, you're writing it anyway. Right? I mean, there's lots and lots of higher level languages. Most of you are still writing C programs. Okay? Anyway, so these are the actions: pick up, put down, stack, unstack, and they stack and unstack, and they're all telling you, you know, the preconditions, what must be true in the state before they can be done, and what things will be changed after they are done. Okay, and then okay, so, and you know, this sort of is now the default in the planning community. Just as CSP community has a default representation, planning community uses this as the default representation. And they have little languages where you can write these kinds of things in some form. So for example, the pickup action can be written this way: action, pickup, the parameters, the preconditions, and the effects. And you know what I mentioned earlier in the beginning of the class, if you have extra time, you can do a little planning project where I can tell you in English a domain, and then you write down actions of this form and you feed it to a planner which can eat it and produce plans. Okay, and the language you would use would be that. Okay? Yes, sir.
Aren't these two different things, determining the effect of an action and inferring the state of the world, and we are combining the two responsibilities under things?
Yes.
So wouldn't it help if we...
Again, so the point you have to understand is we got here. We got here because the more expressive one, which has a lot of flexibility about adding extra action, about adding additional agents and everything, also gives you computational problems. Okay? This is not surprising. In general, higher level languages, compiling them down correctly into lower level languages can be pretty complex. Okay, so there are all sorts of, in some sense what we are saying is, as long as you never really don't have, you don't have to differentiate, you know, those two phases, and as long as you know, the world doesn't change too often in terms of the action semantics, you are better off doing this. Okay? Okay, so that's basically state variable models. And what do we lose with STRIPS action? I just said that. Go read it. I just said basically what you lose, and I that's written in English now. Okay, so what I want to do before I end in the next 5 minutes is, since we have STRIPS actions, these are the actions, these are the states, this is, you know, initial state is a complete state, goal state is a partial state specification. Okay, one thing I want you to understand, by the way, is, as I said, STRIPS representation, this relational representation, is in between the full state transition model, where essentially you could say planning is nothing but I'll just tell you all the states, and for any given state, if you do this action, what state will occur. And the states themselves are black boxes. S100, do action 7, you get S95. Okay, S97, you do action 4, you get S53. That's atomic model. And we are already doing relational model. Okay, and then we tried actually doing first order models, but then we kind of came down in ambition for now, at least until Yun Sang is done. Right? Okay, so the idea then is, how do I do this relational search, for example? Okay, and for example, the simple idea is, do progression, go forward in the space of states, where each state is a complete specification of state variables and their truth falsity values. And the way I do generate, remember that if I want to write a planner as a, you know, I want to write a planner using my first project code, A star search code, I just need to give you what is a state, you know, children function. The interesting thing is, you can write one single children function for all domains whose actions can be represented in this form without knowing what those domains actually stand for. Do you understand? Previously, you were acting as if you need one search program for one children generator function for 8 puzzle, one for 15 puzzle, one for 24 puzzle, one for the path planning, one for something else. Now I'm saying, if all the actions can be written in this form, then I can just write one generic child function. And then the input now is this action representation. And in fact, that's more or less how the existing planners work. So for, in terms of doing this remaining discussion today as well as next class, you will remember all the stuff that you used to think of for search. Okay? So anyway, I have the full state. I can do pick up A action, and then I can consider what happens to the state. I can consider doing pick up B, what happens to the state. And in general, given a state and a list of actions, I essentially can check what would be the new state that can be generated. That's the children generator function. And then what's the goal test? The goal test is, I have told you what must be true for sure in the goal state. So if check, if the state variables that you care about, you know, in this particular case, I said the only state variables I care about, so this is the problem I'm thinking of. A is on table, B is on table, A is clear, B is clear, hand is empty. Okay? My goal is to make sure that B is not clear and hand is empty. Do you guys see this? A is on table, B is on table, hand is empty. I want to be in a situation where B is no longer clear and hand is empty. Do you know how to get there? Just put A on top of B. Okay? But that's a problem, right? And it's an interesting problem because, you know, you need to think like 3 seconds instead of just saying put A on B. You know, you now have to, the only way you can get the property you want is as an indirect effect of putting B on top of, A on top of B. Okay. So what I'll do is, I will generate the states and see if any of them have the state variables that I care about in the correct configuration. You know, B is clear, B is false, and hand empty is true. If so, I'm done. Right? Okay? And this is simple enough. Basically, all I do in generating the child generator function is, if it's pick up A, I make sure, before I do pick up A, I have to make sure that its preconditions hand empty, clear A, and on table A. They better be true in the state, otherwise I won't even use the action. They are true. Because they are true, then I go ahead and say pickup A requires, after pickup A, these must have these values. The red ones must have the values that they have. So I first write the effects of the pickup A down. And then every other state variable, which is mentioned in the initial state, which is not yet mentioned here, you copy them over. So that's the doctrine. And it's very easy to do in program. Right? But essentially what you're doing is you're compiling down the assumption that unless the action says something changes, it doesn't change. That's it. And you have a planner now. And it doesn't look any different from search. Except what you wound up doing is you're able to write a class of search programs without, you write one single search program for a class of search problems. Any problem whose actions can be written in preconditions and effects, it can just deal with them. And the thing that I want you to start thinking about, and I'll get back to this next class, is one of the advantages. So up to here, it looks as if there's not much of a difference, not too much of a difference between normal search, which just told you the action names. And basically in the normal search, the only procedure which knows actions and their semantics is the child generator. Right? Now you are giving action descriptions in some sort of a declarative form, and the child generator is sort of interpreting it. Until now, I didn't exploit it. I'm just going forward. One of the nice things I get to do because I have declarative representations of the action is I can think how to go backward in the search space. Even if the transition function, you know, a normal transition function might only tell you if you do this to this state, you will get this state. Okay? But here I'm actually going to be able to start from the so-called goal state where I want not clear B and hand empty to be true and start thinking of if my last action is put down A, then what must be true before it such that after this action I will be done. Similarly, if my last action is stack AB, what must be true before this so that after stack AB I'll be done. Here I am not reversing the actions in execution, I'm doing reverse of the actions in the search. And this is one of the advantages you have because you know the structure of the action. You can think about this essentially. In effect, what you'll wind up saying is, well, if they put down A, it better be giving one of these things, and whatever it's not giving better be true before, plus everything that put down A requires better be true before. This idea is called regression. And I mentioned this now, and I'll get back to it again next class, but this sort of tells you that having the structure for the action helps you do more than just normal one-directional search. And one can argue that regression search might be more directed because it will actually look at what you need to do and only consider those actions that have something relevant. Whereas progression search, in essence, will have to try and say, well, this can be done, this can be done, this can be done, and then every once in a while, before you expand a state, check to see if you're already reached the goal state. Okay, so we'll talk about regression next class, and we'll also talk about heuristics for progression regression. Okay?